Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode we chat with Casey Wall from Bar Liberty, Capitano, Above Board and Falco Bakery about his move from the States to Melbourne, the experience of his previous venue, Rockwell & Sons, life in the Melbourne hospitality scene, and why the notorious B.I.G. is the only face of hip-hop that you see on walls of restaurants and burger bars. All right. Welcome to another episode of the Food Fight podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. My name's Steph Postuma, your host alongside the rugby playing, flounder eating, sea blight gathering, Welsh rarebit himself, Simon Evans.
Hi, thank you.
Speaking of your mic.
Good intro. If I did a pat nurse, God.
To start our podcast, we'd like to do an acknowledgement of country. So where we are today, we'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather and speak today, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. All right, let's introduce our guest. We're here in the private dining room at Bar Liberty with Casey Wall, owner and chef here at Bar Liberty, Capitano, Falco Bakery, Above Board.
I don't do much at Above Board.
that's what Hayden told us last night as well.
Thanks so much for joining us, man.
Yeah, no, it's great to chat with you guys, yeah, for sure.
It's great to have you on. This one's going to be a very much just like a food talk, a bit of your story, a bit of what you're into at the moment, a bit of what you've got going on with all your different venues and stuff. But yeah, like we want to start to know, like, I mean, you've obviously got an American accent and we want to know what brought you to Melbourne and how you ended up here, a bit of that story.
Oh, yeah, well, I've been here for about 11 years now. I came as, I didn't expect to stay here for 11 years. I didn't really expect to stay here for 6 months. I had these like illusions of grandeur that I was just going to come down and get a job for a few months and then save up some money, go to Vietnam, hang out for a little bit, then get the Trans-Siberian Railroad across to Moscow and then get a train to London and then work in London. And that didn't happen. Not even close. I haven't been to Vietnam yet.
That's the worst way to get from America to London.
It is the hardest way. Yeah, I was obsessed with Dostoevsky and at uni, and I just, really? I don't know, like the Trans-Siberian Railroad was something I just always wanted to do. Yeah, sounded like...
I actually really want to do that too. That's on my list.
It sounds like equal parts amazing and bleak. Yeah. I've been through the time of year. You're just on this train in Russia. That's what I wanted to do. And then it was, I mean, if you would have, in week two when I was in Melbourne, if you'd have told me I'd have been here for 11 years, I would not have been convinced. It was it was a bit of a struggle to find a job.
Yeah, like, right.
I just came from New York and it was, the jobs I was looking at in New York were a lot of like sous chef, executive sous chef kind of roles in high-end restaurants, and a lot of them attached themselves to like 2 or 3 year commitments.
Right.
And I was like, I didn't want to do that yet. I was like, okay, that's the step. I'm going to go away for a few months and then I'm going to come back to that. And so I come to Melbourne. I had a friend that I went to uni with who studied abroad at the university I went to, and he was in Melbourne. So I was coming down here just to hang out for a little bit, see what happened. And I won't name any names, but the first place I trod at was is a Two Hat restaurant. I don't know if they have any hats anymore. So people may be able to gather which one that is. They were like cooking stuff in a microwave. And
wow.
Like, I was, yes, I swear to God. I was like, and I just could not fathom like this kind. And I was like, all right, so I understand there's no Michelin guide in Australia, but there's this hat system. And I was looking at the restaurants that had hats. Yeah. I was like, oh, it's a two hat restaurant. So there's only a couple three hat restaurants. So this is like,
yes, it's similar. Memory. Like the tier is the same.
Like, and I was like, all right, well, this is wild. And I was like, they offered me a job, and I said, I think I'd like to look around a little bit. Then I did a trial at a three hat restaurant.
Can you tell us which that one was?
I probably shouldn't. I was there for a while, and then the owner came in. And again, like, this is probably enough information for anyone to know to gather the restaurant. But they were like, he came in, I was helping this young kid, because at the time I was like 27 or 28. Mm. And I was helping this young kid on larder, and he was going down so hard. And like the chef owner came in, and he was like, what the fuck are you doing? Stand in the corner, don't touch anything. So I was like on this trial, just standing in the corner. And eventually, like, a pastry chef, like, took some, like, pity on me. He was like, oh, this is how we scoop ice cream. I was like, yeah, sweet, thanks, guys. I figured this out. He was just talking to me because he could tell I was, like, I was just stuck. And so I went home. Well, they offered me the position, and I was like, fuck no. And I was like, so I went home, and I started looking for flights back to America.
Wow.
I was like, this Holy is, like... Shit. And then the next day, Andrew... Because I'd messaged Andrew at Cutler asking for a job before I got here, and I didn't get any response. Actually, the only one person responded to me when I was sending out like filler emails, and that was Ben at Attica. And he was like, hey, we don't have any positions, but I'm more than happy to help you find something. Just let me know. I have some friends down here.
That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I was like, oh, thanks for the, you know, if it gets dire, I'll ask him. I never asked him for that.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't meet him for like another 6 years after that, probably. But
that's pretty funny.
And then Andrew was like, come in for a job trial, and he said, meet me at QMOS, because I actually applied at QMOS, and he said, meet me at Cutler, and that's where it all kind of started.
Right. Yeah. So, what was your first position at Cutler?
I just chefed a party. I was cooking meat. It was hectic. We walked in. There's this dish that anyone that worked there would know is like the world's worst dish to prep. It's like this pigeon dish, and it had like 70 components on it. A breast that was cooked sous vide to order, this like little thigh that was boned out, wrapped in pancetta, wrapped in col fat, poached, pan seared. And this confit little, like the drumstick was confit, but I had to pull out all the little tendon and shit. And it was like, oh man, it was awful. It was the worst that's ever.
Man, just like dining 10 years ago. Yeah, and it was like, can I do 20 things with this one bird?
And then it was like brunoise chestnuts, brunoise confit gizzards to put in the sauce and stuff. It was like, it was so fucked. Like, it was such a pain in the ass dish. And I worked there for a year, then my visa was up.
So you come on like a working holiday visa.
I came on a working visa.
Yeah, yeah.
And I probably shouldn't say that. I worked there for years. I just worked there 6 months. <That's it>.
Yeah, me too. I just did 6 months of mine as well.
That's it. And so I actually was dating this Australian. So we just kind of like eventually got a visa together. And I came back and we got married. And that was a good way to say, I mean, I didn't leave the country, but I came back. So I was with Andrew for that whole year, and it was a crazy kitchen to work in. Like, no one, I don't think anyone really knows like the talent in that kitchen. I was listening to your podcast, Alan, earlier today, and he was saying he worked there. He was there before I was there. So I never worked with him, but I mean, obviously I know him. He's a great guy. So it's me, but I don't really rate myself. That's not. Seth James was in that kitchen. He's out in WA. He's at Will's Domain. He's
got
regional. I think he's got best WA restaurant.
Yeah, it looks awesome.
Restaurant. Yeah, like he's doing great things there. Chris Watson, who was running Cutler for a while, and now he's working at Meatsmith. I mean, he's a great chef. JP was the head chef, who was just at Carlton Wine Room. And now he's working with Baker Blue. Sam Lawrence is the head chef at Estella in New York City. He was there.
Cool.
Patty Powell is at Allegra now in London. He's just, it's a crazy awesome restaurant. Yeah, yeah. He's doing great. I mean, I don't know. It's so hard to say what people are doing now because no one's done anything for a year.
Yeah. They were doing this.
Sebastian Myers is there. He was running, I mean, so many great places in London. Mm. Off the top of my head, that's going to
I think out. That's the sign of a good kitchen.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on you define good, but like, you know, some kitchens can be fucking toxic, but they produce loads of great people. But I think that is the sign generally. If a restaurant's produced good chefs, then was going right there.
That kitchen team was insane. And I think, I know like there's some like other kitchens that people talk about in Australia more, but that's just because half the guys have left the country. You know, they were on visas and stuff.
Yeah.
Like if everyone was in Australia running the same restaurants, it'd be like, man, it was crazy. I came in, and then this other guy, Mikey, was there. Ben Sears was in the kitchen. Mm. Mikey he had a Michelin star restaurant in Beijing. Now he's in Singapore. Ben Sears, who had like Paper Bird. In Sydney, yeah.
Paper Bird, yeah.
Yeah, and now he's doing the Israeli food. I'm sorry, Ben, I forgot the name of your restaurant. I mean, it's like just things like that. And it's just like top to bottom, the kitchen was loaded. I mean, Sam who's at Estella now was an apprentice when he was there. So it's like from top to bottom, it was just like super talented people.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And that's like, working with Andrew that's why I'm still in Australia today. Like if he didn't send me that email, I would have stayed here for like a month and spent all my money and went back to New York with my tail between my legs.
Yeah, you know? That's crazy. It was that close like to going. It's pretty wild.
What was your perception of the like dining scene in Australia, like, you know, the differences between what you were used to and what you saw when you got here?
Well, apart from
microwaved food at two hot restaurants, right?
Yeah, that was insane.
I had that moment with frozen scallops.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, where? Well, I saw frozen scallops at the restaurant I worked at in like Threadbow for like 2 days before I bailed.
Right.
And then when I came and did my trial at Cavo,
cold down there, mate. They're just freeze.
Well, I've never seen them. And like, when I went to, I know you can't get them fresh, but like a lot of people use frozen ones. And I went to Cavo and I told Pete, the old owner, and I was like, oh, yeah, buddy, saw frozen scallops this other place. It was crazy. And he was like, yeah, we use frozen scallops. I was like, okay, cool. I mean, when you do, it's fine though. So.
Yeah. When you moving here 11 years ago, it was crazy because it's very much a country rooted in like the British influence in the cooking, like that kind of like. I feel like it was influenced via Britain, via France. And then then it had this like crazy like Pan Asian like sprinkle on top of it. Everything, it was like Asian for no reason. Like, I mean, it wasn't like fusion food. It was just using Asian ingredients in ways I've never seen Asian ingredients used.
They're just very ingrained here.
Yeah.
Like, I just noticed that it's just like things that would be seen as like exotic in the UK were just like staples in the kitchen here.
Yeah, that's it. I did think when I moved here that the food scene was like lagging behind New York's. I mean, that's not fair. I moved from New York to Melbourne, but it was crazy. Like before I moved to New York, I came to Melbourne and I was like, man, this city is so big. And then I like did some more traveling, working around the States and stuff, got to New York. And I was like, I want to go back to Melbourne. That's a like pretty big city. And then I moved back. When I moved to Melbourne from New York, I was like, oh, this is like a country town.
In comparison.
The food scene in 11 years has grown so much. I like 11 years ago, I don't even, I mean, it was such a cafe pub dominated food scene, like some fine dining. There was no middle tier of dining here. It was like some really good cheap eats, whether it was like Lebanese or Turkish or Vietnamese. And then it was some nice fine dining restaurants, but there was nothing in the middle. Mm-hmm. And that's where like New York City flourishes. You have the top of the top there as well. And you have some amazing cheap eats, but that middle ground, like you can eat so much good food in the middle ground, which now it's starting to happen. Like it's happened in the last few years in Melbourne, and the food scene is like super dynamic. You have like young chefs, or not that young, I guess anymore, but people like developing their sense of what Australia is. Mm-hmm. Like they're creating their own, like Australian food's like becoming a thing.
I think that's the most exciting thing that's happened over the last couple of years and is happening now, is the evolution of moving away. Like, so I get me, it was like, is Australian, I was like, literally was like, is Australian food Asian food? Like, is that what, because that's what like like Sepia were doing and Tetsuya was known for, and yeah. that seemed to be like, and even like Attica was a bit Pan-Asian at one time, wasn't it?
Well, I think they were doing, I mean, they were doing like Thai food almost at the beginning. Yeah, or something. So it was like crazy.
That was kind of the, almost the, what I sort of considered what Australian food was really when I first, like 9 years ago. And it's, yeah, seeing everyone kind of try and move into something that is sort of Australia's own is pretty exciting.
Yeah, it definitely changed a bit. It was really interesting. It's very interesting to see it grow. And you get, now you're getting some like second generation chefs, you know, from immigrant families, like doing their take on like, I don't say like Vietnamese and Australian food. It's like, it's so amazing. Like Sunda, like Kana Sunda's like doing, that's like, he's created his own thing.
Amazing.
It's like, it's not, it's very much Asian rooted in Australian ingredients, but it's not the Asian influenced food fine dining that was like 10 years ago. It's he's like, he's doing great things. And then there, you know, there's people turning back to like Joe and Matt, Joe Barrett and Matt Stone are doing like really cool things with like native produce. Mm. Like, yeah, they're both like super switched on about stuff like that. And it's like, it's creating this whole other like culture in Australia, like food culture, which is really neat to see.
Yeah. And, I guess it's kind of like that sort of like New York Italian thing, which has become its own like cuisine. And we're getting that sort of like Australian Vietnamese or Australian.
Yeah, yeah. That's,
you know, wherever it might be.
With the whole like diaspora of like Italy and America and like even like the like sections of Italians that. I feel like the Italian food in Philadelphia is very similar to the Italian food in New York, but it is slightly different. It's like, can you branch out? And I feel that might have never happened in, I don't know why, in Australia, the Italian, because there's heaps of Italian immigrants here, but it almost seemed like that everyone was trying to like just cook from back home, like trying to recreate dishes or whatever. Yeah. And it's like not using the produce here, but.
I think you said it's taken that like second generation where maybe like the parents had a, you know, traditional or Australian traditional, you know, Asian restaurant, and then they've grown up with social media and, you know, the kind of chef boom and the restaurant boom and been like, well, I can take these recipes and like tweak them a bit and fucking charge three times as much and then, like, you know, it's just done something pretty amazing. So I think that's pretty cool to see. I mean, it's just a young country here. It's like still working out what the bloody hell's going on.
Did you, when you first started working at Cutler or, you know, any of the formative places in Melbourne, like we talk a lot about on this podcast, we've talked a lot about how Australia has struggled to find its own identity in food. Did you see that? Like coming from America, did you see that? Were you like, what is Australian food? Like what is...
I'm not sure there is an identity in Australian food. Like, I mean, not to insult Australians because I love it here and I love Australians.
We know there's not. We're trying to figure it out. Like,
I just... I mean, the most like Australian thing is avocado on toast or like a chicken parma.
Yeah.
That's like this is a thing I've been saying for ages. And then when there was a massive cafe boom in Melbourne, it's starting to subside now. They're not like, you can't just open cafes anymore like you used to be able to. But it was like, it was stunting the growth of chefs in Melbourne. I'm not sure how that happened in other cities, but like here, every week you would read an article in Broadsheet or Good Food or whatever about like ex-Vudemont chef opening at a cafe. And like the guy was there for like 3 months, and now this desperate cafe owner hired this kid that's 22 years old to make the same five menu items that are on every menu in the city. You know, it's like you have like the shishuka variant or like adjacent shishuka dish, like a bean dish, a smoked trout dish. And, you know, it's like that was like every cafe, and that for a while it was just printing money.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, and I'm so happy this cafe boom's died because it's definitely stunted like the Melbourne food scene. The other side of that is the pubs, which I have nothing in, I think there's nothing inherently wrong with a pub, but they can do whatever they want and charge whatever they want and no one bats an eye.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of, it's like this cultural staple of Australia that go to the pub with your friends and you order these dishes and it's, or you go to a pub and it's like $38 for a steak and chips or whatever. And no one bats an eye, but then you you like put in like months of development and you do a dish and you charge like $25 for a raw fish dish. And everyone's like, you're fucking out of your mind.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, there's like, this is way different.
Yeah.
This,
like this fish so is much expensive. More value with this fish compared to that like steak and chips.
And that, like chicken parma, you know, some places now are charging like $27, $28. Yeah. And it's like, I know this dish doesn't cost. I know how to cost food.
Yeah.
This isn't some like corn-fed like organic chicken. Like I know what you guys are doing. Yeah, like, how much a chicken breast costs?
Bought in like that.
Yeah,
like, it's bought in crumbs. Like.
Yeah. And I think that something's interesting to note. I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear the thoughts of Sydney chefs on this, but like New South Wales has this pokies epidemic. Like, yeah. I mean, you know, you've got them here in Victoria as well, but not at the same level that you do in New South Wales. And that creates another whole set of issues when it comes to competition at pubs and that sort of thing. It's a different world.
One of our old co-hosts, Andy Burns, who's Babyface. I'm not sure you met him when you were down. But he like lost a pretty good chef to a club once because they were just like, we'll pay you like $80,000 for like a sous chef job. And he was like... Like, what am I going to do? Like, and then, you know, they've just got pokey money. They've got gambling money. Like, they're making millions on that.
Well, whoever went there would definitely hate themselves soon.
Well, you'd hope so. I hope you fucking hate yourself. Yeah, maybe they're just really happy and just having, like, a work-life balance with lots of money. Bastards.
I mean, it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's one thing I could never do is, like, do a job like that. Because that's not why I cooked. It's not what I... like. I mean, everyone, young kids now have it so good with like wages, hours, we make an extraordinary effort to make sure everyone's happy and working good hours and that everyone's like in good shape.
Yeah, for sure. And like, I mean, realistically, it's like, it's not even that they have it good, it's we had it bad.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I should say we had it bad. Like, I remember as working places, I won't say where because like, they know where they are. Like we would work. And then instead of driving home to go to sleep, we would just sleep in our cars in the parking lot because that saved like 45 minutes each way getting to and from the restaurant. And then we would take a shower in the staff change room and then go to work. And I was like, oh, so we can sleep for an extra 90 minutes in the car if we just sleep in our cars. And that's just like, that's what we did. And it was just... It was just crazy. Like, that's what we were told that we had to do. Yeah. And we wanted to be good chefs.
Yeah.
And everything mattered.
Like, I'd just have, like, car naps between doubles.
Oh,
I'd be like, yeah, I got an hour. I'm going to lie down in the back seat.
I don't even know what a double is. There was no break for us. A double, that's a luxury.
You had a break in your doubles?
Like, sitting down to eat staff meal is good.
Yeah.
Like, you know, not shoveling it over a trash can. But I'm not saying this is good or... I do think, and I know you would agree, you may not say you agree on the microphone, but I think our generation of chefs at a certain age, so you take a chef that's 23 today versus a chef that's 23, like coming up when we did, like we are more talented only because we were working. It takes twice as long it's just because it's repetition,
Alan,
right?
I think Alan said this to me at dinner last night when we were talking, and it never really occurred to me. It was just like, if you're doing like, you know, you're doing 60, 70 hour weeks and someone else is doing 40, you're doing every week you do, you get an extra half week more experience.
That's it.
And I was just like, oh yeah. I think about it like that.
It's not, it's not saying that it's a good thing that we did. Cause I would like, if I could live my life now, like when I was 20, I would probably be way happier now.
Mm.
I mean, it wasn't like I was getting more money to work more hours.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Still get a meager pay, but it's like, oh, the experience is what's... And I guess in a way, I may not be where I am today if I didn't work those hours. But there's plenty of kids that are coming up now who are going to be better chefs than we are. And they're not working.
Yeah. I think it's just like, it's a balance. I think the reality of working in a restaurant is there's just going to be some days where you're just like fucking busy and you're behind and you're understaffed. And there's only one way of getting around that. Like, and that's just to work more hours. So like sometimes it's like, yes, we want to keep everyone down to, you know, 30 hours, 40 hours or whatever they're doing. But occasionally it's like, we're just going to have to do a 16 hour day. Like, as if you know a way around it. And like, you have to be willing to do that and willing to put that effort in. Because that's like, for one, you're getting more experience within that. And then that's if you, as an owner or boss, if you've got two chefs and they're equally as talented, but one is happy to like come in hourly to get his prep done, stay an hour later to crack down, the other guy's leaving and you know, starting on time. When you're looking for your next head chef, you're going to pick the the guy who works harder. So it's like, I don't want you to work harder, but like I want you to be willing to work hard. Like,
it's a weird one too. I mean, chefs get fleeced now, like in media about like overworking, underpaid. And I get that. Like fuck people who do that.
Mm.
But there's like heaps of office jobs where they're staying an extra 20 hours. No one's like,
exactly.
Yeah.
Deloitte. Like, oh, those guys are, you know, like they're not paying their interns enough. You know, no one says that shit, right? Yeah.
It's like, these are the cracking down.
Sorry,
nails.
Deloitte.
Yeah, no, like, I've got a friend that worked at NAB and I've never seen someone so stressed. Like, I've never seen someone who stayed fucking, he was just in the office in the dark by himself at 10 o'clock at night banging out like commercial loan, you know, details and all that sort of stuff, because they push them just as hard as anyone. Like in a lot of industries, and that's what makes for an interesting question is like, why all of a sudden is the spotlight on the hospitality industry for specifically this issue? Like why is it? Because I think maybe it's a combination of things, right? Like there's, you know, media out there and news out there about toxic culture in workplaces, you know, drug use, bad habits being fostered, chefs being dickheads to their staff and stuff like that, which goes hand in hand with wage theft, overworking and all these sorts of things. But why is it that hospitality is the one that's been singled out in the media for like unfair work conditions?
See, maybe it's because like there's not master lawyer. You know, we don't make celebrities out of some of these other industries, but then we make celebrities out of chefs. And if you're a celebrity and someone finds out something bad in your past, that's making the news. Mm. You know, like you know, George Colombaris was a fucking lawyer who owned a law firm. Like, he wouldn't be that famous, and therefore the press wouldn't care as much if he wasn't paying his staff. So I mean maybe.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely part of it. And then sometimes it's like, it seems like in like you know, capitalist society or whatever, like in some industries it's like celebrated. It's like these like the stock market is like, it's like an exercise in exploitation. Like these companies are squeezing the bottom drop. They're making money for you as an investor, but they're like, you know, they're underpaying all their staff. And it's like, that's all it is. It's just like an exercise in exploitation. Mm. We won't get too left-leaning in this. I'll stop there. But
I can keep going.
It's a weird, like being a chef is, it's kind of like being an artist, but not all chefs are artists. And there are people who are definitely artistically inclined as chefs. And depending on what level of cooking you do, it's easier to progress if you're artistically minded. Mm. But it's one of those things, like not all of us are artistic. Some of us are, but being a chef is like your identity, like as a musician. Like a musician's a job, but you love playing music.
Yeah.
Or most people, you know, if you're a musician, you more or less love playing music. You may hate it at some point, like anything, but it's like, that's how you identify yourself. If you're an actor, that's a job, but you identify it, your whole life is acting or, you know, singing or any of that. But like being an artist, you become like, this becomes your whole life. And then you just work so hard to obtain something that maybe never comes or never does. But like, and then maybe, cause you're like, you're saying like the celebrity, you can be a celebrity chef. You can. I mean, obviously a musician can whatever, make heaps of money, way more than a chef can.
Yeah.
But it's like it's easy to attack that because being a musician is not a job.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, it is a job, but it's not a job. It's not a parallel.
Yeah, it's like chefing has the kind of the weird balance. Like you don't see anyone in an office job getting like a fucking laptop tattooed on their arm. But like, you know, every chef is queuing up to get fucking knives or a little fucking pig on their fucking arm.
Any bad chef tattoos, Casey?
No, I don't think so.
Simon's got a wine glass. You got anything else on you, Simon?
No, I just got that. We're drunk at a party and someone was doing stick and poke. And I was
Is it a stick and poke?
Yeah, and party tattoo. And I was like, yeah, I'll get a tattoo. And I was like, what should I get? I'm like, fuck, I'll get a wine glass.
Right.
Yeah, I've never got a tattoo. I've like, a friend of mine is a really, really talented tattoo artist. And I was talking to him one day. And I was like, I want to get a tattoo, but I don't know what to get. I was like, I just can't make a decision. He was like, you literally just have to pick something, and that's all a tattoo is. And he's like, it's a time and place thing. It's like,
yeah.
It may be stupid when you're 50, but like that, you just look at it like that's when I was 35, and that's what I thought. You know, it's just like stories. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense. But then it's like, I still know what I want.
Well, I'm just like, I've got three, and I'm just like, I didn't get one for like 10 years. I just can't think of anything I really particularly would like on my body. Like,
there's nothing that bores me more than listening to people's stories about their tattoos and like the significance of their life story and all the countries they travel to that culminated in this tattoo.
Yeah. I mean, chefs take chefing to heart a lot. Like, yeah, it's very much.
But it's so interesting, right? Like, it's such a good, you know, like vector or just illustration of how much people identify with their career path is getting a fucking tattoo of a knife or a microplane. What's the most commonly used like chef's tool, like a chopping board that would be the shittest tattoo?
Like, I feel like you know, we obviously humans are inherently tribal. Like, that's why we root for teams and have like pride in countries or cities or whatnot. And then being a chef, like working in a kitchen is such a close-knit family tribe, like however you want to describe it. Like, these people, you spend more time with the people you work with than you do with your family a lot of the time. Or in some days, especially when you're on and not off, or off. And it's just like everything is so hard. Like, but it's the way we talk of things being hard, it's hard in like hour blocks. Like, I have to get this much done in an hour. It's not like we have a 6-month lead on a dish. You know what I mean? Like, it's like an hour block of like stress. And then, you know, in the heat of the moment, like on a busy service, it's like, it feels like it's us versus them. There's no them. You're just making people happy, right? Like,
just,
you know,
cooking dinner.
Yeah,
just, it's fucking
like,
dinner.
Like, you're helping people like celebrate birthdays and get laid and first dates and weird things. And like, but it feels like it's us versus them.
Yeah.
Like, it's like this weird like war that doesn't, that's one-sided. I guess it's like the emu war for you. Yeah, it's like, but it's just like this.
It feels like a battle. And like, yeah, I mean, the fact that like the kitchens are regimented like an army.
That's true.
Do you know what I mean? Like, and then like afterwards you are just all like, just like fucking black and bloodied and like, we did it, boys. We did it.
Yeah. But it's like, you didn't beat anyone. You just made people happy. You know, is the best part of being a chef, I think, is like, sometimes you like, if you really step back and think about what you do and like, especially like on the level that we like cook at, you know, I maybe a cafe chef is slightly different, but it's like life's like life achievements. Like, I had a great week at work, or, you know, it's our anniversary. It's my birthday. We're celebrating this or celebrating that. And they come to your restaurant to do that. And then you're in the back, like,
just like trying to battling
war against these people who are in love, you know what I'm saying? And then you come out of the end.
Happy birthday, or like happy anniversary. You're like, these assholes, happy birthday. Like,
I think that's why you get these really like shitty tattoos and people like so enamored with the chef life, is because it's just, I guess, you know, in our evolution of being a part of a tribe. And that's what we are, like, in this little, you know, little tiny kitchen or whatever. That downstairs, there's two guys working tonight, a guy and a girl.
Like, I've got people I worked, like, 2 weeks with, like, years ago in a kitchen. And if I saw them, it would be like, oh, my God. And he, like, I knew, like, 2 weeks and we've kept in touch, like, here and there. Like, it's a weird, like,
it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. I like, and it's great because, yeah, you can go back to friendships that you made such, like, there's chefs that I worked with in Canberra that I haven't spoken to in 5 years. But if I find myself with a free afternoon in Canberra, I'll just text him. He's like, chef, what are you doing? Like, do you want to get a drink or something like that? And it's like, fuck yeah, let's catch up. But it's an interesting thing. And I'm going to try to think out loud here about the tribalness and stuff that we were talking about. But I think that, like, you know, finding your identity in a career and finding a passion for something in the way that people who invest their lives in hospitality gives people purpose. And as much as we talk about how there's many trappings, like mental health trappings in the hospitality industry, whether it be drugs and alcohol or, you know, stress or whatever it might be, I think I see a lot of people in the hospitality industry who are like quite sure of themselves and quite confident in who they are and sort of happy with who they are and honest people. And if they do have possible mental health issues, etc., they're happy to talk about that sort of thing because they've been a part of a culture where you can be open about your feelings and stuff like that. And I wonder if in other industries in which you're not as encouraged or there's not a culture of being yourself and finding an identity in your career and in the team that you're in, people sort of are more reserved in those feelings, and that's what can propagate sort of the real serious mental health issues we see in the world and stuff.
I think like the push to kind of people talk and to get help is pretty recent, but I think kitchens have always been like really accepting of anyone, of like misfits, outcasts, whatever. Like if you can hold it down, you can hold it down. Like that's kind of been the attitude. So, I mean, I think that's always been there, and you know, You after a good busy service, when you smash it, you leave the kitchen fucking, you know, like pretty high.
Yeah, it's, and like, yeah, when you
figuratively,
when you've killed the service and everything is smooth, like, you know, you had your mise en place done, there's nothing going, like, you know, you're not in this shit where you like look at your prep list and like, this is going to, these jobs are going to be my Al-Manute jobs, and I'm going to get these jobs prepped for, you know, like if everything's prepped up, you're good, everything's smooth, you know, clean down suite, like, yeah, there's, that's, if you could bottle that and sell it, that would be up there with like whatever Oxycontin, you know, Dilaudin, whatever you want to do it. Like that's, it's such a great feeling. But it's also, you can have the complete opposite. It could be like you're, but that's the thing is like, you talk to these young chefs and they have a, you know, bad day, or you've had a bad day, collectively, or just one person a bad day. It's like, you know, like, oh, you're, you know, are you mad after service? Like, are you mad at me? I think, that was service. Like, like tomorrow we're going to come back and do it again. That's the
legit. Had a day with like that, a Bangalore with like, you know, new chef's been there 6 months, and he's like, this is crazy Saturday. And like between lunch and dinner, I was like to bring everyone out and be like, he's like fucking like coach's halftime talk, and I'm like, we just gotta stick together.
And then just like, get everyone slices of orange and stuff.
Just like, and it was like bring them together, and we like, and we actually like smashed this like 90 person dinner service with like four of us limping into it with like hardly any prep. And afterwards it was like, yeah, good, like I know that was like got hairy, but you guys like, you gotta have a short memory.
Yeah, that's
like,
it.
Yeah. Another day tomorrow. You're back in the tent. I'm going to fucking home.
It's one. It's a weird one too. It's like sometimes when you have a shit service or like it doesn't go as well as possible, but it's not because everyone was slacking off during the day. It's just like one of those perfect storm moments where like everyone's like slightly under prepped, and then you get slammed when you didn't expect to be busy, and somehow like it kind of makes it fun. Like everyone's like in the shit, and you just like, when you can come out on top and no one gets mad at it, that's such a good feeling too. Yeah. Like that'd be second, like 1B of just being perfectly prepped and nailing everything. But like getting through a sticky situation is pretty wild.
But I think that's why chefs are pretty comfortable. I think it's pretty recent that, but it seems like hospitality is pretty good with talking about mental health over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Like
100%.
A lot of initiatives. Like I know like everyone from owners to younger chefs are acknowledging that and looking at that. Lots of good hospitality people, like, you know, the guys with Good Times Only have been doing like what do you call it, the MIDI committee, like every Monday we just try and do something that doesn't involve alcohol for hospitality people. Like whether it's like just grabbing a coffee or doing like a beach cleanup, and like things like that are really great. And I don't see that in too many other industries as well.
I tell everyone that's young to get a hobby.
Yeah.
Like something like a physical hobby.
Yeah. Like outside cooking.
Yeah. Like you have to like engage with something. You cannot just fall into this wormhole of just being a chef.
Yeah.
And that's like the one thing, like here everyone works 4 days, 3 days off. And the rule is like you can never come to work hungover
or anything.
Like, and it's just not so you got 3 days off, like you have, you know, you can't
you got time.
You do what you want to do, but like that's it's not really ever been an issue here or any of the restaurants really. And I'd say I'd come from a fairly privileged, like obviously I worked hard and I worked for some asshole chefs in service, not necessarily as people, but in service. But I never really worked in a kitchen where like drinking or drugs were a thing. Like it's just, I think we were all working so hard. Like the idea of doing drugs after service is like,
I think sometimes I'm like, I could never do a service high.
Yeah, I don't know who could do that shit.
I think it's a certain level of chef, I guess, where that's a bit more of an issue.
Well, some people can. Like, I know that there's stories of people working in, you know, having like in high-end restaurants, just like doing like lines and stuff. I was like, I just can't imagine.
Yeah.
I'm pretty like I can't do that.
I want control when I'm like in the kitchen. It's just baffling to me. I don't know how.
I've worked in restaurants like that.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild. It's a weird fucking culture.
Yeah.
Like, because the thing is as well, is like it divides the team in a really weird way as well. Like there's this like little crew of like, you know, people who want to do culture in service, and like this is true. It's like bore witness to it. But like, and then there's like everyone else, and it's like, oh, these guys are doing this. Like, I don't know. It's fucking it's bad. And there's nothing good about it. And I'm glad that it's being reported on. Like people are talking about it, and food media is talking about it. Like about bad cultures in hospitality workplaces, because nothing good ever comes of it. You're never going to foster a positive culture.
For sure. It's kind of weird. Like in drug use and stuff, it becomes like not 100% chefs. There's also front of house people, but it almost becomes like their personality is like, oh, you know, I'm the high chef. I'm the high bar. I don't understand like why this has to be a thing. I understand there's like substance issues and all that stuff that happens on the backside of it. It's like, but it shouldn't be a place that fosters it. And it's lucky like no one here in our restaurants, you know, is an issue for us or has ever been an issue for us. And I think the industry is definitely moving away from it.
Mm. Did you put any like things in place when opening restaurants to like tackle that? Like was it, were you like, right, everyone's going to do 4 days or everyone's going to be like, you know, under this many hours? Like,
no. We opened up Rockwell in 2011. And that was 2012. And that me and my business partner, Manu, who now we have all these businesses together. I was working at Cutler. We started doing dinners together, like pop-up dinners just around town. Because he had just moved back from New York. He's from New Zealand. And, you know, we started talking about New York and we started doing these pop-up dinners and had some really good events in like warehouse spaces and people's houses or events at breweries and other little things like this. And that just, a restaurant space became open and we had no money. We opened up a restaurant for $18,000.
Wow.
We had no money and
that's like no money.
That's no money.
That's like not even a drop.
You asked your parents for that money. That's no money.
I mean, it was just me and him split it.
Yeah.
And then me and my ex, like she went to the bank and cleared out our bank account to put money in the till for the bank in the till, like to make change people. And me and like, to be 100% honest, me and Manu had no business opening a restaurant, but we did. And, it became gangbusters. Like we closed it down maybe 2 years ago now. I have to do the math in my head, which I won't come quickly. We closed it cause we were just tired of doing it, which is like a weird kind of, that doesn't really usually happen with restaurants. Usually they just fizzle out or
it's good to realize that though.
Yeah. We just don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Like cause a lot of people just push through.
You're so allowed to say that, but it's just weird for a chef to say, we just closed it cause we didn't want to do it anymore. Yeah. Like you never hear chefs like that.
The restaurant we opened was, I know it'll sound like cocky to say this, but I don't mean it in any sort of like egotistical way, but like it was ahead of its time We were trying to open this thing, this style of restaurant that we were super familiar with in like Brooklyn, which is kind of like these neighborhood restaurants where you could have like really nice main courses, but also like you could just sit at the bar and eat a burger or whatever that was. And it's like, you know, we were getting in whole pigs, whole goats, whole lambs, like doing like constructed dishes, like composed dishes and stuff, like getting like great produce from farms. And our biggest fault was we just made this burger that was delicious and everyone wanted it. And that changed the nature of the restaurant. Mm-hmm. You know, you start, we're still selling those dishes that we love to cook, but
you're a burger bar.
It was not enough to justify to keep making them.
Yeah.
And it turned, and now there's the restaurant we opened is very much what is kind of like the normal restaurant now, like this like scope of like casual fine dining kind of vibe. Yeah. Like you can rock up in your like, I don't know, Nike sweatpants and just eat, like, you know, drink a bottle of Plessard and eat a burger or whatever. Yeah, you know, not that we have burgers downstairs or anything, but it's like this, that's how people do restaurants now. Like it's like you don't have, there's no like, there's the pretense of what you have to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's a blur of things where before it was like you have this level, that level, that level.
Yeah.
Now, and like, you know, this is a dinner restaurant, this is a lunch restaurant, this is a breakfast thing. Like the restaurants are very much blurred now.
Yeah.
You don't have that, like, talk about this.
Like I guess at Night Parrot, you guys could cook whatever you wanted.
Yeah.
You know, like whatever you could, like whatever you wanted to cook, well, you guys would sell it.
And we get people who come in for like dinner and like, you know, they're like, we're going out for dinner tonight at Night Parrot. And then we get people who come in at like, you know, 11 o'clock to get hammered.
Yeah, that's
like, and it's, we just get this like strange mix and this progression throughout the day and throughout the night over like 10 hours of just people coming in. Seems to work.
Rockwell was crazy times. Like we got to the point where we were doing on a Saturday, like with lunch and dinner. Like, and it was not a small restaurant. I mean, it was not a big restaurant. It was a small restaurant. Mm. And we would do like 300 or over 300 covers. And it was just like so crazy. But the other side of that is like the industry loved it. Andrew like was super great to me. Like I can never thank Andrew enough for like him just in media saying like, oh, you know, I like Rockwell and Sons and blah, blah, blah. And like him, like anytime there was like an interview or something, he would just like drop the name and help us out. And he was so great for that. And then, you know, he would bring in chefs who were in town. And then we started, and it's funny because a man who worked at Attica for a little bit and then came, for instance, Banjo and Michael, who were our business partners when we opened here. Michael's still involved, but Banjo's moved back to Adelaide. So we bought him out. And then it just became this wild thing. Like anytime there was an event in town, like the after party would be at Rockwell. Like,
I
the list of the world's best chefs have probably eaten at Rockwell. It's like, it's insane. Like I could just start naming people off and it's insane, like, who we cooked for.
Give us a couple.
Oh, I mean, like, Sean Brock, Enrique Alvera, Anaki.
That's pretty fucking cool.
Yeah, that's not bad.
That's not even, like, that's yeah. half. I'm trying to think. The guy who has Din in Tokyo
is
amazing. He's so awesome. I can't think of his name right now. This is like, I'm so sorry to everyone listening to this. he loves the burgers. Occasionally he'll like send me, like not for a while, like, but he'd comment on like photos, burgers and stuff. He loved it. But it was like after like the, like so many different events, we just get so many people, like Melbourne Food and Wine Festival or when Ben did stuff at Attica and it was just,
The Hospo hangout.
Yeah, who's the head chef from Cellar Ken?
Jordi Albert. Isn't that two on that?
Or yeah,
there was the other one.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were in. Like,
so Jordi Rocker.
Yeah, yeah.
I was in Albert.
There's three brothers.
Yeah, they were through.
Yeah. Like that's amazing.
He was like trying to talk to me, and I spoke Mexican Spanish.
Yeah, right.
And he spoke Spanish. Yeah. So they were like, we're both like saying the same words, but neither one of us could understand each other. That was pretty fun.
That's
like
amazing. Someone
was like, "Oh, you speak Spanish?" And I like, "Yeah." When I lived in America 11 years ago, I was like kitchen fluent.
Yeah, yeah,
in Spanish.
Yeah.
what was it that you think made Rockwell what it was, and what were you doing differently specifically, like, and especially with the food and the burgers and things like that?
Well, when we started Rockwell, there was, I mean, the what's that burger chain down the street? Daniel Wilson's burger place, Huckster Burger. That was that had been open for a few months, and but outside of that, there wasn't that many burger places in Australia yet, and it was pretty much like if anyone would, like any fine dining chef would open a casual restaurant, you just do things 10 times harder than it needs to be done.
Yeah,
like we but and that's like, what made it good. Like we just
Well, because imagine, like, you weren't setting out to be a burger joint. You were just like, let's put a burger on.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, if I'm going to do a burger, I'm going to do a really fucking good burger.
I mean, that's really it. We just made, like, the balance of, like, you know, salt, acid, fat, like, in the burger. Obviously, the fat is the easy part. You have to balance the rest of it in a burger. But it's just, like, making it taste good. And it's consistent year-round. Like, it wasn't, there was no vegetables on it. It was just sauce, cheese, patty, bun. So, like, you know, from
No beetroot.
from March to June to November, it was the same. You could come in, it was the same every time. You know, we hand cut the chips. We had this pressed rib sandwich that, I mean, we were making like classic French pressés out of like pork and then putting that in a sandwich. It was like things that like people that just don't do, you know, like reducing the braisage down and then using that to set the pressé. And then and it was like things like that. Like
for sandwich.
Yeah, for a sandwich. It was stupid. Like it was so much labor. Like, but I mean,
but when, delicious.
Like it is. It's that's why it was better like than a lot of places. I mean, there's people who make good burgers, but it wasn't a money grab for us. I'm not saying anyone, I'm not saying like Dan Wilson when they opened Huckster Burger was a money grab, but I do think 1,000 other people afterwards saw it as a money grab. It became
especially in the last 5 years, like anyone opened a burger joint because there's money in burgers.
Well, do you think Neil Perry opened a burger joint because he loves burgers, or
Shannon Bennett, whatever, that Benny Burger, that place flopped pretty hard too. It was like that stuff is, but there's so many other places who just saw it as a money grab. And I do believe that the like, I know I definitely cared, and I've talked to Dan a few times, and I know he cared about it. And it was like in the beginning, it was like it was something that we liked, and it wasn't a thing in Australia, like a burger, you know.
Yeah,
it was like, you have some of the classic ones
just,
around.
Yeah, you just have the burgers with the lot. Like for a long time, the Australian just burger was the burger with the lot from the fish and chip shop that has pineapple, eggs, bacon, beetroot.
That's so fucked.
Fucking everything.
I don't know who would want to eat that.
Like
I don't. I'm not.
It's weird to think that they're like. The burgers weren't big here because it is massive now. Well, like
it aligned with the GFC, right? So there for a while, the Australian dollar was worth more than the American dollar. So everyone all the time was just flying to America. It was like, we'll fly to LA for whatever. And then it's like, it got to the point where it was like $1.20. I think it was up to $1.20 the Australian dollar was worth to the US dollar.
Yeah, wow.
So it's like you'd go to like awesome restaurants in New York City and like laugh about how cheap it was.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
the opposite now. It's so expensive.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
So with tax and tip and stuff, it's insane.
Yeah.
I just remember going there and like, I don't need a new pair of shoes, but I'm going to buy them because they're so cheap here, you know? Because they're already cheaper than they are like paralleled.
Yeah.
And then
the dollar's good.
And the dollar's good. And I think there was a massive American food boom that paralleled the GFC because so many people were going to America and it became kind of trendy.
The whole world looked at like Brooklyn, especially that time. Like everyone was like renovating the restaurants the same way, you know, making restaurants in the same like kind of spaces and places, trying to replicate the food. And it was a massive boom probably around that time, probably like 2010, 2015.
Oh yeah, I mean it's definitely, and that was the GFC kind of vibe. It was like, that's when that was happening, and it became so popular. And I remember telling Manu, I was like, you know, because we were always, Rockwell was always at the fore. Any trend that happens, there's like a few restaurants that do that trend or produce that food that do it well. Mm. And then there's 30 people underneath them. Those 30 people go out of business in a year or so. But the three top of the that trend are still trading 10 years down the line because they're good restaurants. Yeah. They've done it well. And there's not like there's no ulterior motives of opening a restaurant. They just wanted to make good burgers or good pho or good ramen or something. You know what I mean? It's just like these things that people are like care about. Mm. And then it's like, oh, if ramen becomes popular, then you get 50 shitty ramen restaurants.
Yeah, yeah.
And then 5 years time, those 50 will suck, but the five good ones will still be trading. Mm. That's kind of how the American food was too. Like we just, I don't know, we tried to do something and kind of happened. And then I remember joking with Manu that I would have, if we took Rockwell and moved it to North Carolina where I grew up, we would have less competition than we did in Melbourne. And it's that's at a point. It was just like every other corner was a burger place or someone trying to do fried chicken. And I mean, you're not Australian. I mean, you're Australian, but like, what the fuck is it with Notorious B.I.G.? Is that the only rap artist that Australians know?
Dude, it's like I don't know what.
Biggie on the wall.
To be honest, I reckon, like, I think that there were a lot of people who liked Biggie that are around my age, maybe a little bit older, like I'm 34. I reckon I saw a change when the fucking Notorious movie came out, eh? I reckon there was a lot of people who just jumped on the Biggie bandwagon. They were like, Juicy's the sickest track. Like, and yeah, I don't know. That is a very good question.
I saw a meme recently. It was like a piss take menu. And it was like, how to name your menu. And it was like, how to design a bar. And it's like, Biggie mirror on the wall. Yeah. One needs to be like, one chicken menu needs to be called Juicy. One needs to be called Notorious P.I.G. Or like you have all insane. These fucking hip hop puns.
I was like, there's so many. I mean, like, yeah, all right, Biggie was great. No one actually really knows he released one album. How many rappers
posthumous one?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to say. I don't want to like hang shit on Biggie, but it's like he could have sucked after the next album. You know what I mean? Like it's like no one knows him, but he died. I mean, he didn't die. He got killed at a good time for his career. I guess that's a fucked up thing to say. But now it's just like in cafes in Melbourne. There's a fucking fried chicken joint. A kebab shop, you know, I am almost certain that he would have never eaten a fucking kebab in his life living in Queensbridge.
Oh, of course.
I don't understand. I mean,
do you think he'd ever be muraled on the side of a kebab shop in Newtown
or a fried chicken place or a bar? There's a place in Sydney that's like,
Big Poppers?
Yeah. What the fuck? I don't understand. I'm not saying he's a bad rapper, but there's so many other better rappers out there.
It's just funny that, there's like an Aussie obsession with Biggie.
I know, I don't know. It's hip hop as well. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. Like, I don't know. There's something about young people and opening restaurants and being part of that cool trend, and they're into hip hop and stuff. And it's like, I don't know. I remember eating at Hatted restaurants in Sydney, for example, where like you've got. I remember looking around. I'm not going to mention the name of the restaurant that I was eating at, but I was looking around.
See if
and
I can guess it.
you should be able to. And like, it was a great restaurant, but I was looking around and everyone there was like middle aged, or like we were the youngest people in the restaurant, and like all the art on the walls were like a lot of the art on the walls was like Biggie and hip hop art and stuff like that, and I was like. Who are you appealing to here? Like, are you literally just doing that because
that's weird.
Do you love Biggie that much? I don't know.
You know we're middle aged now, right?
Yeah, are we middle aged?
Yeah, that crushed my soul last year. I got a kidney stone, and I went to the hospital for it. And I was like, "Is there anything I can do to make sure that I never get this kidney stone again? Because this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me." And I broke my pelvis in half in a car accident, and the kidney stone hurt worse. And he goes, "Nah, it just happens to middle-aged men." And I was like "Middle age?" I was like, "Watch your mouth, man." Middle-aged. I was like, "Yeah, I guess technically we are middle-aged, but don't say
it. It's all those extra hours you worked." It's like, you know, that's a week in your life. You got 1.5 weeks to every week for a chef.
It's
chef years.
Yeah, it's so. Yeah, I mean, I do appreciate hip hop because that's what I listen to all the time.
Mm.
Who are some of your favorites? The ones that are much bigger than better than Biggie.
Who's better than Biggie?
A Tribe Called Quest.
Yeah,
that's my 1A is a Tribe Called Quest, and 1B is Outkast, which is controversial. I grew up in the South, so everyone's favorite hip hop group in the South is Outkast because they were like they put Southern rap on the map.
Mm.
I mean, there's other people that did obviously as well, you know, like Timbaland and Jermaine Dupri and stuff like that, but. A Tribe Called Quest for me is, that's I mean, I love all their stuff collectively, but if you listen to Anthology, which is like their greatest hits, like sometimes I'm just at the house, I'm cooking dinner or whatever for my girlfriend, and I'm listening to that. I'm just like, I become so insecure because I can never make something that is good as this collective one. You take all my most popular best dishes, and like they don't have the reach of a Tribe Called Quest. You know what I mean? I can never be that good. And you're just like, fuck, man.
You got to stop listening to that album. if that's where you go when you're listening.
I mean, I love it. I just love how good it is. You know?
And yeah.
It's just like they did so much for hip hop in the way. I mean, like, it kind of always, like, I guess for me also, like, cycles around like DJ Premier and stuff too. Like he's always there. Wu-Tang, like it's for the children. That's great.
Outkast were my one. I think I had this list of like bands that I really, really wanted to see live in my life, and Outkast is the only one that I still haven't seen. And they fucking came out like a few years ago and played, and I missed
really?
Them. Anyway. Yeah.
Missed a chance.
All right, well, we're just talking about hip hop now for the podcast. Like, we can keep doing that.
Just to wrap it up.
Yeah, I guess we can wrap it up. Like,
I had a little question to ask.
Yeah.
With Rockwell being quite a sort of hospo spot, and I think there's a lot of power in being a good hospo spot. And like, Liberty's kind of got that reputation as well. Like, what do you think you've done to get that, to get those people, to get other chefs, other bartenders wanting to come to your venues?
It's just being like not. I think you just got to create something that you want to be at. You're not trying to create. It's not really necessarily an ego-driven thing. I get, but it may sound like that. It's just like you kind of like remove yourself from what you do. If that's even possible, it's not really, but like theoretically, just remove yourself from what you want to do and then ask yourself, is that a place you'd want to spend your day off at? And that's what we did when we set it up. Like, that's just what we want to have, like an interesting mix of wines, tasty food. Like the biggest thing for us when we opened Liberty was never to make anyone feel like they had to use the space in a certain way. So if you wanted to come in for a glass of wine before dinner, that's fine. Sit down, have wine, and then go to dinner. And then when we first opened, that happened all the time. It was this weird thing that people would come in, have a glass of wine, you know, have some fun, listen to like different music and stuff, go to dinner, then come back and have more wine. And then they were like, well, maybe we should just eat here.
Yeah.
And they just kept building like that. And people would come in and like Banjo, he went to great lengths to like curate an awesome wine list. Josh is doing great things now, like the people, the wine that people want to drink.
Yeah,
it's like building this thing. It's like sometimes we get pegged as a natural wine bar, and we are. We never put stuff on the menu that uses pesticides or stuff like that. But there's some classic wines on our list.
It's not this thing with like there's heaps of classic wine that is natural.
Yeah, that's like, but people don't.
But it's not natty.
Yeah,
I guess it's like there's a difference there.
Yeah, we get like I just remember like older people just pegging us for, you know, like whatever. Like, no, just come and order. Like, just talk to someone and you can order wine that you like. I swear to God, you'll find something you like on the list. It's not that confronting. Like, just because there's not like, you know, 17 Pinots by the glass, like, hey, you can find something to drink. I swear to you, you'll find something. and that's just how it is. And like Capitano, when we opened that, it was like just making a space that. You know, we just want to serve like us. I don't know, like making pizzas consistently is the hardest thing I've ever done. I've worked every kind of section in a fine dining restaurant. Like making pizzas consistently to the level that we want to serve them at is so fucking hard. But I eat there more than any other place. It's Capitano and Minamishima. That was the two places they had the most.
But the spread.
I love going there and eating pizza. Like everyone that works there cares so much. Blake, who's our head chef, we work together, but a lot of the stuff that we opened up with was like my ideas and my recipes, and he's taken it and ran with it. He creates some great dishes. Our sous chefs, Sam, he is super. He cares a lot about what we do and like how people perceive the food and the experience. So it's like, and they've both been there since day one. And it just, just building these venues that you kind of want to be at.
Yeah.
Like, do you want to we'll have a pasta and like an amazing bottle of wine. Or you can just come in and have like a nice, because over there it's all Italian varietals made in Italy or Australia. That's kind of the way the wine is. Here it's anywhere. But it's just like, here you can come and have a nice glass of wine, not too expensive, you know, have some nice food. And you could have a couple snacks and go somewhere else or whatever. There, you know, you can have a pasta and you could buy, you know, like a nice wine from, you know, the Adelaide Hills or something. Like get like a wild bottle from Sicily or like Etna Rosa or cool something. Like, yeah, and it's like you can. It's like choose your own adventure, and I think that's what everything we do with our venues is choose your own adventure. Once you start pigeonholing people into a notion or an idea, you start excluding people. You're always going to exclude people because and people will hate what you do. And sometimes I honestly feel like people hate what you do just because they like it too much. They're like, oh, this place sucks, because they like it. I don't know. It's just weird thing with like, especially with like chefs and other.
Yeah, yeah. I definitely love hate some people. I'm like, damn it, why the fuck are you so good? Fuck.
I do think for anyone that is still listening after that hip hop interlude. If you want to open a business, I think the choose your own adventure, either that choose your own adventure or complete singularity are the two ways to go. Like I do one thing and I do it well, or you provide people the template to have as much fun as they want to have. Cause we have people here that are like come in on a Tuesday for a quick meal, but then they'll come with their business colleagues on a Friday and buy like five bottles of wine and go like to town on it. And we give them that platform. And that's like the cool thing to like knowing the regulars here and the regulars at Capitano, how that stuff works. So.
Awesome. That's really, really cool insight. And it's the type of place I like to eat and like to drink at and stuff as well. Those choose your own adventure types of places. It's probably time to wrap up. We could talk for hours. Like,
yeah, we could keep going.
We haven't even looked at any notes or anything. I've got a fly in my face. But yeah, might as well wrap it up there. But I reckon this should be the first of many chats. We'll do one with you, like an unprepared podcast every time we come to Melbourne, where we just start talking about like
Liberty Series,
the types of bikes you like to ride, and, and whatever.
We'll just do an exclusive hip hop one.
Stop listening to Biggie.
Yeah, there you go.
And or at least stop putting on your restaurant walls.
Yeah, and naming your dishes after him. Casey, thanks so much, man. It's great.
Thank you, guys.
Cheers. Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.